Christian Picciolini used to be a neo-Nazi. His star rose quickly in the world of white supremacy. He became a well-known musician in that world, but he's now working at helping others leave hate groups like he ultimately did. He grew up in Blue Island, a Chicago suburb. He says his parents were hardworking Italian immigrants. We'll get to Picciolini's story more in a moment, but first, there's a point that he and other former white supremacists want to make very clear. It has to do with current events, with a group calling themselves the alt-right. The term was coined in 2010 by Richard Spencer, who doesn't like being referred to as a white supremacist, yet quotes Nazi slogans and calls for, quote, peaceful ethnic cleansing. He and his followers reject mainstream conservatism and call for what they refer to as white nationalism. The Trump administration chief strategist Steve Bannon used to be executive chair of Breitbart News, a website that Bannon has called a platform for the alt-right. Meanwhile, while the terminology is relatively new, especially for the majority of Americans, people like Picciolini say the alt-right is nothing more than a freshened-up version of the sort of ideology he used to subscribe to.
What we're calling the alt-right these days is, in fact, what we called neo-Nazis back in the 80s and 90s. There's really no difference other than the packaging that it comes with. They've learned through our efforts many, many years ago that if they blend it in and they mainstream the ideology and just toned it down just a little bit to be slightly more palatable to the masses and focused on people who had an underlying grievance, that they would be able to infiltrate and convert more people onto the cause. And we're seeing that today. And certainly they're feeling a lot more emboldened because of our political climate. What was these smoldering little ashes and fires that were spread out all across the country on election day? It was as if a bucket of gasoline was kicked over onto these sparks and suddenly ignited a large-scale fire. And that's something that we're battling today. And we're seeing evidence that, you know, while they may have put down the swastika flags, the rhetoric is the same, the ideology is the same, and the mission of really creating a white homeland and expelling anybody who isn't what they would consider a white European out of the country, that is their ultimate goal.
Fake news is something Breitbart has been known to spread. For example, the conspiracy theory referred to as Pizzagate, in which it was written during the election cycle that a pizza restaurant in D.C. had ties to politicians like Hillary Clinton and was part of a human trafficking ring. Unsubstantiated claims. In real life, though, it resulted in a gunman shooting up the restaurant in D.C. called Comet Pizza. Picciolini says fake news was around when he became a neo-Nazi in the late 80s.
Even before the internet came along, I mean, we were handed flyers and leaflets, and we spread the false propaganda and fake news by word of mouth. It was very face-to-face at that time. And also through our music, you know, we had a lot of platforms that had the same effect as what the internet is doing now for fake news. I think what the internet is doing now with news agencies like Breitbart and a lot of these other fake news websites is that because there's so much information online, it's become so hard to distinguish what's real and what's fake, what's propaganda and what's parody. And they've really keyed in on the fact that there are millions of young people who may feel socially awkward or on the fringes of society who are sitting behind computer screens all around the world. What I call the rabbit hole effect of kind of what we see on websites like Amazon, where you buy a product and it recommends another product that you like. Well, a lot of those same algorithms exist on social media. So if you begin by clicking on some of these fake news sites, well, you're going to be fed those same stories over and over and over, and you go down a rabbit hole that's very hard to get out of and get a differing perspective from. So it's a very dangerous situation. And there are many young people who are disenfranchised with politics and with politicians, with law enforcement, who are really ambitious and looking to change the world. And once they stumble onto these facts, it's very difficult to understand that they're not true facts or that they're inflated or that they're completely skewed, such as black on white crime statistics, which somebody like Dylann Roof saw, and it encouraged him to go out and commit a horrific act of multiple murder. So it's a very dangerous situation where we've got to be able to discern what is credible and reputable news versus what is propaganda and fake news. But it's happened for decades. The platform has changed, and it's something that we need to stay on top of and identify as a problem.
I'm Rachel Otwell. We're talking with Christian Piccolini, a peace advocate, a musician, an author, and one of the founders of Life After Hate, an organization in Chicago that helps people in hate groups from all over the country leave that lifestyle behind like he did. Piccolini says his family was loving, that he didn't learn hate at home, but his parents worked so much, he says, he felt somewhat abandoned. He wasn't fitting in at school, and that's when it happened, when he joined one of the most violent and extreme subcultures in America.
One day, when I was 14 years old, I was standing in an alley, and I was smoking a joint, and a man came up to me who was twice my age, and he grabbed the joint from my mouth. He looked me in the eyes, and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" Being a 14-year-old kid, I didn't really know if I had known what a communist was or if I'd met a Jewish person, and I hardly knew what the word docile meant. But I was suddenly struck with this man's charisma, because he wasn't telling me not to do something because it was stupid or because what other people think. It's as if he gave me a reason to protect myself from doing those bad things. So I started to look up to this man, and I very quickly realized that he was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader. And the year was 87, and I didn't know what a skinhead was. Most of America didn't know what a skinhead was. But I was really struck by his power and his charisma when I felt the most powerless. And I was instantly attracted to the lifestyle he was leading, even not having any idea what the ideology was about. It was really three primary things that I needed at that point, which is not unlike any other teenager in the world. I was looking for an identity, I was searching for a community, and I was driven by the sense of purpose, and happened to be intercepted by somebody with a very ideological and hateful agenda.
And so I was going to ask, and I have a better sense of it now, but if you could just kind of explain, you know, was it hatred that was at the heart of your desire to join a neo-Nazi group or something else?
No, I you know, was raised by immigrant parents who were often victims of prejudice themselves. So hatred, you know, and violence wasn't something that I was brought up in. It wasn't a foundation of who I was or how I was raised. And for me, it was really about fitting in, about finding that community and that identity that made me feel powerful when I felt the most powerless. But the ideology certainly came very soon after that, because that was the one, the tie that bound us all together. If you wanted to belong to this group, if you wanted to be seen as important, if you wanted to experience that power, well, it came with an ideology, and I very quickly learned to adopt that ideology.
So tell us a little bit about what the meetings were like, what recruitment was like. For you, it seems, you know, pretty random.
You know, it wasn't random at all. I mean, having been a recruiter myself after I was recruited, it was a very strategic effort to look for young people who were vulnerable, who were kind of living on the fringes and felt marginalized, because it was easy to promise them paradise. It was easy to promise them a solution for the problems that they were experiencing by simply placing the blame on somebody else for causing those problems. And, you know, the meetings were in the early 80s when skinhead phenomenon was very new, were filled with alcohol and rhetoric and a lot of anger and music. Music was really made and specifically tailor-made for spreading propaganda and for inciting violence. And white power music was something that influenced me greatly. And I actually went on to form one of America's earliest white power bands.
That band was called White American Youth. This song was the group's white supremacist anthem. It goes on to use the N-word and has lines like, "Our heritage is strong as much as it is great. By putting us down, you bring forth hate." In the beginning, you can hear the sounds of glass breaking, representative of the violence inherent in white supremacy and neo-Nazism. Piccolini says it was a propaganda tool for spreading the hate rhetoric. He spent 8 years in this lifestyle, becoming a leader, One of the first moments he realized he wanted out was during an episode of violence.
Where several of my friends and I were drinking late one night, and we went to a McDonald's restaurant after midnight. When we walked in, the only people that were there were three black teenagers who were buying food. And, you know, I walked in and loudly said that it was my McDonald's and that they should leave. And of course, because they were scared, they ran out of the restaurant and we chased after them. And when they crossed the street, one of the black teenagers pulled out a gun and started to fire at us, but his gun jammed. When we caught this individual, we beat him very badly. And I still remember this moment very, very vividly, because as I was kicking him and he was on the ground, there was a moment where I looked into his eyes and I suddenly had this moment of clarity, of empathy, where I thought, this could be my brother. This could be my son. This could be somebody that I cared for. And I knew at that moment that my beliefs and actions had consequences. And that was actually the last moment I committed an act of violence and stepped back, really, from this group that I was leading.
Do you find people are surprised by how much violence is prevalent in these groups?
People are always alarmed at the level of violence. You know, we often hear stories of people committing hate crimes or violent acts based on ideology, and we think that they're just these one-off kind of coincidences, and they only happen in, you know, towns in the South or far away from where we live. But the truth is that the ideology is very pervasive. It's ingrained in our culture, and there are hundreds of thousands of people who now don't look like I used to. They don't shave their heads or wave swastika flags, but are now wearing suits and ties because of a concerted effort that we had 30 years ago to actually try and blend in. We recognized early on in the mid-80s that we were turning potential recruits away because they were afraid of the swastikas and of some of the rhetoric that we used. So we decided that we were going to tone it down and make it just a little bit more palatable to the masses. And we decided, you know, enough with the tattoos, enough with the shaved heads. Let's enroll in college. Let's wear a suit and a tie. Let's go and find jobs in law enforcement and run for public office. And in fact, 30 years later, that's exactly what we're seeing. So I think that the problem is much bigger than people understand it to be, because while we don't see skinheads and Klan really marching on our streets like they did in the 80s and 90s, we have many of these people who've now blended in into society and have mainstreamed the message and now feel very emboldened by the administration change that is saying some of the same things that we said 30 years ago.
That's Christian Picciolini, a former neo-Nazi from Northern Illinois. He started a group in Chicago called Life After Hate. He says there's definitely been an increase in interest since the election. Those who want help can initially seek it anonymously through the organization, says Picciolini.
We have three types of people who reach out to us. We have people who are in hate groups or have hateful ideologies that recognize that they don't want to be there anymore and they want help getting out. We also have what we call bystanders approach us. It could be parents, could be friends, family members of somebody that they're concerned about is going down that path. And we also have people who manage to find a way out of these movements on their own and now are looking for support. They're looking for other people that understand the problems that they went through, because most people don't understand what it's like to be in a hate group and some of the challenges that come with leaving those groups. You know, we try to offer a level of support to all of those people. We have an online private forum that acts as a virtual support network where some days, you know, people are posting funny cat memes, and other days, you know, somebody will reveal for the first time in their life that they were sexually abused, and we rally around them and we really try to support them. And the group is made up of roughly 100 people who've done amazing things to counter all the negative things that they've done in their lives. Some have gone on to PhDs, some have become architects, some are nurses, some are teachers, some are parents, and they really understand each other for what they've gone through and are able to forgive themselves and receive forgiveness from other people for what they've done.
So what's the takeaway for you as far as having gone from really early in your life becoming a leader in the white supremacist movement to someone who now has, you know, gone on to the other side. You're helping people. What's your takeaway as far as how people can come together and leave these sort of hate ideologies behind meaningfully?
Well, I think we have to embrace empathy. We have to make that step to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes and walk a mile in them and really understand the challenges that they face. Because it's really easy to hate somebody. It's really easy to blame somebody else for the problems that you have. What's hard is love, because when you love somebody, you risk losing something very dear. But the rewards are so much greater from that. And we've, to some degree, lost our sense of compassion. We live in a climate where many times we have to fend for ourselves. And if we can't provide for ourselves, it's difficult to help other people. And we really need to reconnect with that compassion and empathy that we're losing, because we really are all human beings with the same fundamental needs. And while we may have differences, those are cultural differences and very superficial, but they're also differences that enrich us rather than push us farther apart. So we just need to be able to humanize each other and understand the pain that somebody else feels, because oftentimes we'll recognize that we also experience that same pain and that we could use the help as well.
Picciolini says our society has yet to break through and grapple with hate ideology at its core. Part of the way to do that, he says, is by having tough conversations. It's something the organization Life After Hate is doing, one person at a time.
You know, what we do with our organization is very important, because not only are we former members who understand the mentalities of the people that we work with, we also understand that what changed us was receiving compassion from the people that we least deserved it from when we least deserved it. And that's exactly how we approach all the people that we work with. We approach with compassion. We don't battle ideologically with them. We know that that'll push them further away from us. Instead, we listen. And we listen for the things that they say that explain the deficits that exist in their lives. And what's amazing about that process is once they get the tools that they need to compete and be able to support their families or themselves, the ideology tends to wash away pretty quickly, because from the beginning, it was a crutch for them. It was just a way to blame somebody else for the problems that existed. And we've been very successful with that method. I have built a large network of people that we've helped who've gone on to do really amazing things completely dissolve the ideology and now focus on more positivity and diversity and inclusion and teach that to other people as well.
Earlier in this story, we listened to part of a song Christian Picciolini wrote for a neo-Nazi band he was once in. Still a music lover, I asked what song he may want to end the story on. Fittingly, he chose Redemption Song by Bob Marley. The group Life After Hate aims to create many more of these stories of redemption, stories like his. I'm Rachel Otwell.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, all I ever had, redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.